And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This weekend is the annual Christmas Festival at Carthage College, and this year its theme is And on Earth Peace. Later in the hour, you'll be hearing from Dr. Peter Dene, who is the coordinator of the Christmas Festival. In part one of the program, I want to replay for you a conversation from 10 years ago with Dr. William Roth, who passed away earlier this fall. He was longtime college organist at Carthage, and for a few years was also conductor of the Carthage Choir. This conversation from 10 years ago was just ahead of a special concert marking the 30th anniversary of the dedication of the beautiful Fritsch Memorial Cassavant Pipe Organ. And I asked Dr. Roth on that occasion to reminisce about the design of this beautiful organ.
As Dr. Lentz had a vision and dreaming about our new campus plans in 1957, which was my first year at Carthage. And, of course, we confided together about some of these future plans. And the plans were that the realignment of the Lutheran Church allowed Illinois to have two campuses, Augustana College and Carthage, only 9 miles apart, but Wisconsin had no college from our church group. So we elected to look into establishing a new campus, and it came out, to make a long story short, at Kenosha, and of course they opened up that campus in 1962, and I came up with the group of 14 faculty members. And at that point we began talking about someday having a chapel and, as Dr. Lentz put it, with a pipe organ that would be the finest that money could buy.
And your mouth must have been watering as the guy who would be playing that organ for years to come. Probably yes. Very gratifying for you to know that was an important part of the plans. When Carthage first got to Kenosha, there, I assume, was no chapel on the campus. Where did things happen back then?
We used the Wartburg Auditorium, and we had a small instrument, a small pipe organ, put in that chapel. I shouldn't say it's a chapel, it was the northernmost building.
Now the Straws Science Building.
Yes, and but the big break came in 1966. We began to assemble material on the installation of a big pipe organ. The chapel was in the works to be built, and the first big step was in 1966 when I took the Carthage Choir on a 45-day European tour, and we gave 35 concerts, which Phew. Was a hectic schedule,
yeah.
Greg. And to save the singers, I would play half of the concert on the organ and the other half directing the Carthage Choir. And doing 35 concerts, I became exposed to these beautiful sounds of these European instruments. And I thought to myself, here is Siebert Chapel that we want to put in an instrument that's going to have these kind of sounds.
Mm. So as you're going through these four or five different countries across Europe, right. You're hearing all kinds of different organs and all kinds of different settings and getting all kinds of ideas about what Carthage should maybe have. Very good.
So with Dr. Lentz's approval, in 1969, 3 years later, I returned to Europe again and took along 12 brass players. So the Carthage Organ and Brass Choir toured Europe, and we did about 25 or 30 concerts. And again, I played some of the famous tracker organs.
Let's explain to our listeners what we mean by a tracker organ.
Yeah. The Carthage organ is a tracker. Actually, the word tracker means simply this. There's no electricity in the console of the instrument. The only electricity is to run the electric motor for the blower. For blowing the air. So here we have a completely mechanical way. When you push down a key, there's a tracker lever. It's a wooden strip that goes to the base of the pipe and opens that valve. You have to have that valve open. Most pipe organs have an electromagnetic magnet that is energized when you push down the key. But on the tracker organ, you have it firsthand, the actual connection from your, just like a piano, with your finger pushing down the key and opening that valve. And this allows a great amount of accuracy in the type of touch that you use on organ.
Right. So you played some of these great tracker organs in Europe, and you tell me you also got to meet some of the people who were responsible for building and designing them.
Oh, this was a mountaintop experience. I was able to meet with von Beckerath in Hamburg, with Karl Schuka in Berlin, whose factory, by the way, was right on the wall.
Oh, really?
Oh, that was that experience. I looked out the window, and here is East Berlin.
Wow.
On one side of the building. And this was a tremendous, to see all the fortifications and things.
Wow.
But Karl Schuka wined and dined us there, and also got down to meet at the Steinmeier organ. And these are some of the most famous builders. For instance, von Beckerath spoke five languages, you know.
Wow.
And these people are very well versed. I told them what we're doing at Carthage and began to assemble this information. Also on that tour, the Lutheran Church gave me an improvisation grant to study improvisation from different Europeans, and I wanted to bring that information back to Carthage.
Wow, very good. Well, at what point do these ideas you have about Carthage's organ start to take shape? I mean, at what point does somebody say, okay, let's get this thing built?
Well, finally, in 1971, our dreams were realized. Dr. Lentz said, "Bill, you have done your homework. We will now order the organ." So, at that point, Jack Frisch, a Carthage College trustee, donated the entire track organ. So we were just so grateful to Jack and his wife, Judy. By the way, Judy, I taught piano down the old campus.
Ah, so they gave the money.
Lasting donation to Carthage.
Holy cow. I had forgotten that sprang from an individual's gift like that. Wow. So what happens then? How does the organ actually get finally designed?
Well, the big day was in 1972 when we had a big meeting. You see the gray hair, heavy, from these main programs.
Yeah, right.
Dr. Lentz, Jack Frisch, who donated the organ, and three of the final organ builders that were competing for the contract. One was, of course, Cassavant, which we have. But von Beckerath from Hamburg had a very interesting bid. And we had a third party also. What happened right in 1972, the German Deutschmark became less value, and the Canadian dollar, where Cassavant was located, went up. And this big difference in the world money market came in just in time to favor Carthage.
Wow.
So we were able to get the four manual instrument, the full tracker within our range of the donation. And
so the choice had something to do with economics of the moment.
Yes, but the second big thing, Greg, was that here, when I was in Germany on these different tours playing these organs, I kept hearing the name of Brunzuma. And he had his own organ company in Europe. But that year, Brunzuma joined Cassavant. They brought him over to Canada, to St. Hyacinth, a little village outside of Montreal. And he was their tonal voicer for Cassavant. And when I heard that, I said, well, here's the combination of that I want. A Cassavant is French, the little town of St. Hyacinth, all they speak there is French.
Hmm.
And I thought, here I had the best of the French organ with a French builder with Gerhard Brunzuma from Germany. And that combination is why we chose Cassavant. Hmm.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about the organ itself. Were you able to decide okay, I want these kind of stops with these various manuals and so on, or does the organ come kind of already packaged up and you take what they give you?
No, every instrument is a custom, especially with the big ones. Each one has its own trademark.
So you can choose exactly what the stops and sounds would be, pretty much.
But, Greg, you've got to watch out. One builder will call a French reed stop a certain name, and another builder will have his own way of calling that. It won't be the same name, and it won't be the exact same sound either. Mm. So there is a custom individuality of a competition between the builders.
Interesting. And I suppose finances has something to do with it, too. I mean, you probably couldn't afford to have everything and anything. You had to choose wisely.
No, how true.
I remember you coining the name Albert Schweitzer once and talking about the organ at Siebert. What does that great name have to do with this?
Well, many years ago, early in my college teaching career, I had followed Schweitzer's life. And here, the International Albert Schweitzer Fellowship was right in Racine, run by Les Paffrath. And I was very excited about this, and I talked to Les, and they gave me a grant to go to the Albert Schweitzer house in Gunsbach and play the organ that Schweitzer did his recordings on. This was a mountaintop experience that I never expected. But Schweitzer had predicted that, he said, in 50 or 60 years, there will be a return to the fine tracker organs of Europe. There will be a return, and they will come about. And I wanted to be in on that.
Wow.
And there were only one or two trackers when this organ at Carthage that was put in 1976. There were very few in the United States, and we were among the first, and for a while, the biggest first organ of a tracker type.
In the country.
In the country.
Wow.
68 ranks, 4 manuals with a full pedal.
Wow. As it's built, I know that people from Cassavant had to kind of come down and oversee that process. Anything interesting about that you want to tell us about?
Well, yes. Brunsema, 1973, we signed the contract. And Siebert Chapel under construction, which was really something. And right near the end of it, Brunsema came there. And he made the sound recordings, which is very important. You want a live room. And we had the tile floor, and we had the hard plaster. And he checked, and we came out with 3.5 seconds reverberation, which he said was ideal for the organ sound. And, of course, I just had a sigh of relief again. And we brought in Robert Nairn from University of Michigan, who also backed up and gave us input on the registration. So Brunsema and myself and we had a couple others were able to formulate exactly what we wanted on this 4-manual instrument.
I imagine at some point it went the other direction, that they weren't just coming down to Kenosha. Were you heading up to Canada to the factory at different points to see this process through as the organ was built?
It was under construction, and in 1974, I flew to Montreal to make the final commitments and final specifications and choosing the way the organ is going to look in Siebert Chapel. And I went to St. Hyacinthe, this little French village where the organ was, and consulted with the tonal designer, Gerhard Brunsema, for the 68 rank Cassavant. We had the specs and the layout and the facade. It's really fascinating to see how a pipe organ is built. A big surprise for Cassavant was, unknown to them, as we just finished, after 3 days of consultation there, they said, "Is there anything else we can do for you?" I said, "Oh, yes. We have the organ already ordered. Now I'm ready to order another pipe organ." So we ordered the 9-stop organ that's in our recital hall.
Oh, okay.
And we ordered that at the same time. And I said, "We want to rush on this one because we need something for us while the big organ's being built." So they finished that in a record time of something like 10 months.
Wow.
And got that shipped to Carthage.
Very good.
So very happy.
Tell us about Christmas 1975. This was a red-letter day.
Well, this was perhaps the special day, again, I flew to Montreal and entered the Cassavant factory, and they escorted me to a room and held this door open, and I walked in, and Greg, I can't tell you what a sight after all these 12 years of planning. Here, the door opened, and I looked up, and for three stories high was the facade of this beautiful oak facade with all the beautiful pipes, and it just took my breath away.
Oh, I'm sure. Now, to get that thing to Kenosha could not have been any small matter.
Well, they had the organ dismantled, and that was Christmas of 75, and in January, they disassembled that organ, put it in two big semis, and again, imagine the excitement outside of Siebert Chapel, these two semis backing up and unloading all of that casework, 3,500 pipes in the organ, and they spread these all over the whole floor of Siebert Chapel. Just imagine what a sight that was. And so for the next 6 weeks, the two French voicers, one down below and one up top, talking French back and forth, voicing every single one of those 3,500 pipes. It took them 6 weeks. So that was exciting. It was not easy for me to attend to my teaching duties.
With all that going on.
With all that going on for those 6 weeks.
Oh. How was the organ finally dedicated? I imagine some kind of blowout recital of some kind occurred.
Yes. Later that spring, I had talked to Dr. Paul Montz, perhaps the greatest improviser in the United States. He had also studied in Europe with Flora Peters, by the way. But Paul Montz and I had talked to extent, and I invited him to share the two dedication recitals. I played one on Sunday, and he played one on the Friday before, and we had full houses. So it was very, very exciting for both of us.
Longtime Carthage organist Dr. William Roth, in a conversation recorded back in 2006, just ahead of a special concert commemorating the 30th anniversary of the Fritsch Memorial Cassavant Pipe Organ in Siebert Chapel. Here is a brief excerpt from the recording called The New Old World Sound at Carthage College, Professor Roth playing the music of George Frederick Handel. That was William Roth at the Fritsch Memorial Cassavant Pipe Organ in Siebert Chapel. This is from the recording that he made called The New Old World Sound at Carthage College. And this was an excerpt from the Organ Concerto No. 2 in B-flat major by George Frederick Handel, with Professor Roth displaying the various colors and timbres of all the divisions of the organ and playing on all four manuals. And joining me now in the studio for this portion of the morning show is a faculty colleague of mine, a current faculty colleague of mine at Carthage, Dr. Peter Dene, who also happens to be a proud Carthage graduate. And he is extremely busy at this point in time, already busy because he's been teaching a ferocious overload at Carthage this semester. And on top of all of his directorial and teaching duties, he is also coordinator for one of the mammoth events of the school year at Carthage, the Christmas Festival. And those performances are coming up this weekend. This year's theme, Let There Be Light. And we want to talk about that, but we're also going to talk a little bit about Professor Roth, since Peter Dene knew him as a student, as a matter of fact, as a family friend as well, and has all kinds of fond recollections to share about William Roth and his connection to Carthage College. Dr. Peter Dene, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. So we were listening just now, and it's amazing how a recording can kind of bring somebody back to life in a sense. It's it's as though he's right with us.
Yeah, listening myself, I don't think I of course I've been at Carthage, back at Carthage now 11 years. I've not heard the organ played that way. I think when he played it, you could tell that it was there was some kind of connection between him and that organ, that he knew how every nuance, how to bring out every voice in that organ, and made it very special, come alive. I think the organ comes alive under his hands, or came alive under his hands.
That's very well put, and I absolutely agree with you. And when you listen to him talk about all of the decisions that were made, all the choices made in the design of the organ, and he had, of course, a very direct hand in exactly how that organ was put together, it makes all the sense in the world that that he should know all of its colors, all of its potential, and would and just revel in the opportunity to show off all those those colors. So I was going to ask you a couple of questions about Professor Roth, since I knew that he was a professor of yours back in your student days at Carthage. But you were just telling me before we went on the air that your connection to him goes far deeper than just student-teacher. Tell us, first of all, how you, your family and the Roth family are rather tightly intertwined.
So I grew up in the Fox Valley, in Menasha. My mom was born in Neenah and grew up in Neenah. And Bill Roth's father was my mom's pastor as she, when she was a child and growing up. And then when I was in high school, I joined the church choir at my church in Menasha, and Bill's brother, Sam, was my choir director there at the church. I had my own kind of lawn mowing service, and I mowed his mother's lawn all through high school, and just had lots of connections with them. And music was a part of their music, and faith were a big part of all of the whole family. And so part of my connection looking at Carthage and coming to Carthage as a high school graduate was through my connection with the Roth family.
In other words, that was a big reason why you chose Carthage?
I think that's why I looked at Carthage, encouragement from them, and then chose Carthage is a different question. I think because of the person I was at that time, I was really just drawn to the small college atmosphere, and every faculty member that I met. I think I met all of the full-time faculty at Carthage and had an individual meeting in each of their offices when I came. so that's what I needed. I needed being the first person in my family to go to college. Going to a big school kind of frightened me. And coming to Carthage and having that connection with Bill Roth, but also just all of the faculty were welcoming, and I knew I would kind of get the care that I thought I needed at a small school like Carthage.
So he was one of your teachers. Explain that specific connection. What exactly did you take with Professor Roth?
So he was his main class that he taught is a course called Aural Skills, A-U-R-A-L. And that's basically training your ear to be a musician, and so 4 semesters of oral skills with Professor Roth, and I also took 1 semester of organ lessons, not a required thing for me to do, but something that I was interested in having some experience, and I still practice those pieces that he assigned to me when I have a chance. I sneak when nobody's around, because it's very hard to hide on the organ in the chapel.
Yeah,
I'll sneak
right.
in and do a little bit, usually on breaks like after Christmas or something.
Right. So what was he like as a teacher?
I think he was the same as a teacher as he was in any situation. He was just a person who you could tell loved life. He loved people. He loved music. He had a joy in everything he did, and worked to make people feel comfortable, I think. And so oral skills can be a place where lots of students struggle in music. You start that in your freshman year, and it's something that many many people don't, many students don't have experience doing it unless they did it in choir. And so he was able to make it a place where it was very non-threatening, very open, and experiments and being free to fail.
You know, one of the things that I think is very tricky about oral skills is that it's a place where natural ability plays a really big role.
That's right, of course,
also if you've had some experience with it. But in many, and it's also a very public kind of thing
exactly,
most of the time. And
yeah.
So it's a place where often a given student might quickly realize, oh my gosh, I am 20 miles behind student X or student Y who are doing all this dictation very easily or hearing these things flawlessly. And what's wrong with me? It's often a place where a given student who's been a very successful musician suddenly doesn't feel successful
exactly
anymore.
Right. Yeah.
And I suppose the way Professor Roth taught oral skills was a way in which to make some of those students maybe initially struggling not feel quite so bad
That's
about
exactly
themselves.
Right. Yeah, and he also had perfect pitch. So he was coming at it from a position of not really he could have, like, if he were a certain kind of person, he could have no empathy for somebody who doesn't have perfect pitch. I mean, if you so being able to his brain was working in a completely different way than probably the vast majority of the class, but was able to understand, have empathy, and encouragement to succeed.
I don't remember if you said this, but exactly why did you take that semester of organ lessons with Professor Roth? Did anything in particular prompt you to do that?
Oh, I think it was because I thought he was a neat person, and two things. That again, this openness something that I had never done before. Of course, I'd taken piano lessons before, but and then trusting that I was going to be studying with somebody who wouldn't be judgmental in a negative way. I mean, when you're studying with someone, they're judging you, but encouraging was the main reason that he was somebody I wanted to be around more, and that was an opportunity to do that.
As you look back at your 4 years at Carthage, 4 years was it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, sometimes
yeah.
music students it's
Can't
a lot
assume,
longer.
That's right.
Yeah. But for your 4 years at Carthage, do you have any specific, particular memories of working with Professor Roth that really stand out to you?
I have I can't remember. I think it might have been in my sophomore year. It must have been my sophomore year. At that time at Carthage, there was a thing called brass choir. We don't offer that anymore, but it was a large brass ensemble with organ. And we would do mostly performances in the region, but for J term, January term, one semester, and I think it was my sophomore year, we went to Florida and toured Florida for I think 3 weeks. We were there for quite a long time. We had a van and we drove down with a wagon on the back or trailer on the back. Dr. Winkle was our conductor, Ken Winkle, who lives here in town. And Bill played the organ, and so we traveled down to Florida. And I think my one of my fondest memories was not a music memory, but we were in I think Key Largo or one of the keys, and Bill Roth rented a catamaran, a small catamaran, and asked me if I wanted to come sailing with him. And I had never been sailing before in my life, and it was just a great afternoon, kind of talking and sailing in the keys. So that was a special memory of mine with him.
So we are looking back. As it turns out, this conversation that we replayed at the start of today's morning show was 10 years ago, and it was recorded just ahead of a very special concert that commemorated the 30th anniversary of the Fritsch Memorial Pipe Organ in Siebert Chapel. And so that was a concert that featured the current Carthage organist at the time, Michael Burkhart, and Marilyn Stulkin, who was a past campus organist, and Professor Roth, the three of them playing this wonderful concert. And then, so as we replay it now, both in Bill's memory and in commemoration of what's now the 40th anniversary of the organ, we're also replaying it, of course, in timely fashion in anticipation of this weekend's Christmas Festival performances at Carthage College. And maybe one of the things we should say right off the bat is this is not an interview to sort of cajole people to get their tickets, because, in fact, there are tickets to get. Just tell us how rapidly this sold out this year and maybe why, one reason that happened.
So sold out, we actually don't sell tickets. We require tickets for admission because it's a very popular event, but there's no charge for those tickets. And we, you know, we try and estimate the size of the audience, and it's always an estimate every year. So we set a boundary of the number of tickets we can give, and it's usually the same every year. This year, I've been the festival director now, I think, since about 2005 or six, and when I started, Friday night was always open. That we never filled up. We were sure that if somebody called and said, "I want tickets for Saturday," and we could say, "Well, you can come on Friday." But about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, all the nights started filling up before the event. And so this year it was the earliest ever. I think by the second week in November, we had filled all of the tickets that we were giving that this year. So we're out of tickets. If you're disappointed, I'll let you know that you can begin ordering tickets October 2nd next year. And we do it all online now. And unfortunately, I don't have the email address in my head right now. But October 2nd, if you put it in your calendar right now, you can order your tickets for next year. Mm. One quick thing, the title for this year is End on Earth Peace. I think you had said then Let There Be Light at the
Oh, I sure did. Sorry about that.
So, and on Earth Peace is our theme this
Which
year.
Is a great theme, yeah, a very, very yeah. timely theme indeed. Absolutely. So, first of all, how do these Christmas festivals get put together? And by whom? In terms of, for instance, selecting a theme and selecting the hymns and just putting it all together. You are coordinator, I suspect, actually a whole lot lands on your broad shoulders.
Sometimes I put it usually starts sometimes the day after the festival, sometimes not until January after the Christmas festival. But sometimes I'll put out a post and say, does anybody have any ideas for themes? Or sometimes I've had one that's been running in my head for a while and I just put it out as the theme. And so the theme kind of can be generated by me or anybody. Sometimes someone will say to me sometime after the theme has already been picked for this year, you know, what about this for next year? And we'll just go with that. So the theme usually is the first thing that gets picked. We do have a kind of breakdown afterwards to say, you know, what do we need to work on for next year? And everything. We do a lot of things the same every year, so they're, you know, following the same format, hiring the same people to help, and so we have a great crew involved. So there's not a lot of that has to be talked about as far as, you know, this didn't really work, but we're always, I guess the big thing that I'm always conscious of, and I think my colleagues are, is the length of the program. And so I'm constantly trying to figure out ways to tighten it without sacrificing quality or the experience of our students.
Hmm. Tightening without rushing.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Or making it so that somebody I think the natural thing is to just kind of keep cutting minutes from when people can perform, but then those ensembles start to feel slighted. And so making sure that there's enough time that somebody, an ensemble, can give a quality performance, or sometimes it's more than one piece or a couple of pieces, that the students feel satisfied having stepped on stage, and the audience feels that they made a connection with that ensemble. So that's really the main minutes thing, one of the things that I did just a couple of years ago, and now we're doing it fairly often, I don't really like it that much, but it works, is we've gone to mostly doing just two verses of every carol. And a lot of times people just love to sing every verse. Mm. And if you look out in the audience, most people are singing them from memory. So for some people, they wish they had sung the whole thing, but maybe they can do that on the drive home or something. but that's one way where they get a taste of the Christmas carol or the Advent carol. But we're not able to give them the whole thing in order to kind of keep it somewhere between 90 and 100 minutes.
Right.
Also connected to, so the preparation, the big thing is putting the program together. And so once the theme is announced, sometimes Jim Ripley is always the first one. Almost as soon as I send off the theme, he says, oh, that's great. That works with exactly what, and he sends me the pieces that he's planning to do. And that can almost come 6 months ahead of time from Dr. Ripley, but a lot of us take a little more time, not sure of what our ensemble is going to be every semester and all of that. But for me, I usually have a few pieces that I've got under consideration and make that final decision when the choir comes together. So the big thing is getting that program together, and we work with the communications office and it takes several drafts. Most of the information goes out. They get about 90% of the program in September, late September. And then some of that information, like the participant lists at the back, fill out towards the end of October, beginning of November. And then once the program is published, but under a couple of drafts, there's very little changes. We're just trying to make sure that we've caught all the mistakes and get things moved around.
One of the things that people who attend it always remark about is that not only is it a lot to experience in terms of what they're hearing, but what they're seeing. And a big part of that is not just sort of the artistic placement of the choirs, but this dazzling use of light.
Right.
Explain who comes in to make all of that wondrous effect possible.
There's a fantastic company out of Milwaukee called Go Audio, they run both our lights and our sound for Christmas Festival. And if you've been there to the performance, the chapel is transformed in many ways. And one of the physical structure, the inside, what you see, one of those things is we actually have a light. I don't even know what it's called. I'm not a tech person, but we put up all new lighting every year for the Christmas Festival. That's done by Go Audio, and it's basically two people who are the owners and runners of this thing. They have lots of people who work for them, but what's neat is every year they come with something a little bit newer or different, and you know, with digital lighting now and LEDs, there's so much you can do. And Aaron, the sound guy, is always excited to show me, you know, look what I can do with this light now. And so you'll see, and they're also, he and the sound guy are also very artistic. So they to me, it never seems to go overboard, and it seems to be connected with the music that's being played. So the lights change constantly throughout the show, throughout the performance, and are meant to enhance the music that's being heard. One or two people every year who say that it was a distraction to them, but almost to everyone else is saying that it enhanced the program for them and made it more special.
Right. So that's 1,398.
Yeah, exactly.
4 and 2, I guess. So that's right. Pretty clear. Yeah, and I'm always impressed, particularly because I'm sure in a lot of the other things they do, they are providing lighting and sound for events that are nothing like the Carthage Christmas Festival.
Big but rock they, shows and stuff like
right,
that.
Right, but
exactly.
they adjust beautifully to the effect that you are after.
One of the neat things that was added 2 or 3 years ago was before and after the performance, they actually light the steeple on the chapel, which I didn't think was possible, but it actually, the lights go up through the skylight in the inside. And so as people are coming and leaving, they can see this beautiful steeple that I don't even know how many feet it is up in the air, but it's changing colors from red to green to blue.
And I had no idea that it was coming from inside Siebert. Wow. And, of course, the walls, the outside walls of Siebert are also multiple colors. It's a gorgeous sight. And, of course, another interesting thing about what the Christmas Festival is now is that once upon a time we had a number of participants where all of the students could be inside Siebert for the performance, and now we have so many musicians involved that in a sense there's no room for them to be there.
Yeah, I think my first year as festival director, in 2005 or 2006, we still seated all of the musicians, the students inside the chapel, kind of on the seats that are the last ones to fill up now. And then that next year we decided, let's give out more tickets and see if we're able to fill the whole thing. And we did. And so we have monitors throughout the Johnson Arts Center and the chapel, where students are watching the festival. And in our dress rehearsal, the Wednesday night rehearsal, they're allowed to stay inside and watch. So they get a sense of the whole thing. But they're not able to be a part of inside the festival when it's going on.
Hmm. So there are three performances this coming weekend, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon. As we already said, all of the free tickets, unfortunately, are gone. In the last several years, there has been a live stream over the website. Is that available?
Yes, it is available. Again, I don't have the website, but I'm sure if you go to carthage.edu, there'll be a link right on that homepage. To the live stream. It starts about a half hour, maybe 45 minutes before we have some we call gathering music. So you can log in early, and there'll be a program available for you to download, so you can follow along, you can sing along. Mm. If you have a candle ready, you can light your candle with us at the candle lighting time and all of that.
And I know that all kinds of people have taken advantage of that, including literally hundreds of Carthage graduates who are spread out all over the country who are so grateful for that. So it's not just for the sake of people around here have lost out on the chance to get tickets, but also for people anywhere who are interested in experiencing this. And I have to say, the crew that captures it visually does a wonderful job. It's the next best thing to being there.
They've invested in some very really nice cameras, and the students are. It's mostly students who run the cameras. We have Mike Murphy, who is the engineer of it all. But they you'll get nice shots, and the audio is very clear. A lot of things. The first year that we did it, there were lots of issues, and the first year you do anything. And every year it's gotten even better and better. It's a really sound production now.
Mm. So we invite people who can't attend in person to go to carthage.edu, and all three performances are live streamed.
Right. So Friday and Saturday night, the performance starts at 7:30. So the stream should start at least by 7. And then on Sunday, it starts at 4, so 3:30. You should be able to log on.
Very good. Real quick, at the end of this really brutally busy semester for you, in which, among other things, you're actually now conducting two choirs rather than one. So you have an especially busy Christmas festival, not just as coordinator, but as conductor of two different groups. And then in January, you head off to Tanzania for the first time.
Namibia.
Yeah. And remind our listeners about your connection to Namibia.
Yeah, I was in Tanzania last May for the first time.
Yes. Right.
Namibia, so in 2010, a colleague of mine, Ann Cassidy, and I brought a group of students to Namibia for the first time. It was my first time traveling to Africa, and I was just really enchanted with the experience and the experience that the students had, especially. And one of the unique things that happened while we were there in 2010 is we visited we were in the north central part of the country, and we were planning to visit an orphan center where a Carthage grad was serving as a Peace Corps worker. When we arrived, they had a choir that sang for us as we entered the facility, and And then the choir gathered in a spot and sang several songs for us, and then I taught them a couple of songs, and it was a really special experience. And when it was over, the director of the Orphan Center asked me if I would come back. One thing I wasn't totally aware of when I was doing it is that there aren't very many adult males who these children have an opportunity to interact with. And so just being able to interact with someone, adult male, in a positive way was a interesting and great experience for them. So I came back. So that was in January 2010. I went back in July of 2010 to specifically to work with the choir and create a Christmas CD that we could sell to raise funds for the Orphan Center. What's just quickly about the Orphan Center, it's not a place where they live. It's a place where they come every day. There's about 500 kids, over 500 now, who come after school every day, and for many it's the only meal they have each day. There's some grandmothers who come early in the morning and start a fire, and they start making this meal in the morning to be served that afternoon, these huge, huge pots of maize meal. Sometimes they have some meat or vegetables to add to it, but at least it's a iron and enriched maize meal that the kids get every day. And so they come there, they get some other services. There's some social services that they can have there. There's a playground, which is a big deal because it's the only playground that I've ever seen in Namibia. And so a place where they can play on swings and things like that. So I work with the choir and we made the CD. They're still available. They're $15 a piece. The wonderful thing is when we produced it, there was a law firm in Milwaukee that paid for all the production costs. So there's no expense for the CD. So that $15 for the CD goes directly back to the Orphan Center. I'm planning to send, I usually send a check around Christmas time or before Christmas time. So they can, usually she buys a bunch of chicken. So that they can have chicken for Christmas, and so that's or around Christmas time. So I'll be sending off a check probably early December, mid December, and so if anybody's interested in one of these CDs, they're $15 for one, $25 for two, and you can. I don't have a website anymore because it's been a while, but if you're interested, you can call me at Carthage. I'm in the directory, 262-551-2159, 262-551-2159, or you can email me. All of that is available on the Carthage website.
And it is a wonderful CD. I own it myself, and it is just a joyous, wonderful collection. So it's something people should really, really think about getting for themselves. Dr. Peter Dene from Carthage College, thank you so much. Best wishes
pleasure.
To this weekend with the Christmas festival and all that's beyond.
You're welcome. Thank you, Greg.